offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari. We are here to continue with the final discourse in the 1991 Summer Course series, the 13th discourse, in fact. And this particular discourse is not on any particular Upanishad like many of the other discourses in the series. This one is a very general discourse on the concept of dharma itself and how important the concept of dharma is in Indian spirituality and culture. I think that is the essence of this particular discourse. We played a couple of clips already, I think three clips to be precise. Before we proceed to play the clip for this week, and before that to summarize whatever we've had so far, and before we do both of that, let's begin by inviting Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Hari.
I think last week we were talking about, Swami had started that topic of dharma and how it is very important in the Bharatiya context, where I think Swami spoke about the role, the way the epics like Ramayana and Mahabharata is presented, where the characters who probably in the modern day parlance you would say they are losers, literally they've lost their kingdom or they've been asked to leave their kingdom, be it Lord Rama and Ramayana or the Pandavas in the Mahabharata. But how throughout the story, I think that's the beauty of storytelling, that even as the story is being narrated, you know who is being portrayed as the hero, who is being portrayed as the one who has to be looked up to. So even though you see them going through phases in life which you and I would not like to go through, you know that they are the people who are being held up. And I think that was what Swami was referring to when Swami said, compared to Ravana, Rama seemed to be a less acclaimed, whether it was knowledge or whether it was wealth, but Rama was being held as an example. Same is the case with the Pandavas also, where they spent most of the time in the forest, but clearly Vyasa was holding them up as somebody whom we need to emulate. Right? Swami was talking about that. And in fact, even within Pandava, Swami would make that reference, where Arjuna was more talented, Bhima was more mighty, but still Yudhishthira was the one who was more important because he was the one who was holding on to dharma all the time.
Yes. Like if you actually look at the history of the world, you will see that the primary place as far as people's memory is concerned is occupied by spiritual giants. Like not people who really achieved so much in various other fields, like maybe they were kings, maybe they were people with extraordinary academic achievements. But in the end, I think the most remembered, across the world are the spiritual giants.
Right.
Like we have got the epic, in the epics we speak about Lord Rama, Lord Krishna, we have Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, all of them like across, the worlds. Like to give you an example, if I ask you like Persian kings, we'll not remember any particular Persian king, but if we ask you about a Persian mystic, and right, immediately the name of Rumi comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We don't know anything else about the history of that land, but Rumi, yes, like right, everybody knows the mystical poet. So it is the spiritual giants who occupy, and the reason why they occupy is, among all conquests, across the world, these are the people who conquered themselves.
Right.
And as such, that achievement is singular in all of the achievements that a human makes.
Right.
And that's why it's like innately we know that this is an extraordinary person.
Right. And Swami is making reference to them. I mean, looking at it this way, even the characters of Valmiki and Vyasa themselves, I think even they stand out as a certain example, because Vyasa is not born into a family which is very rich, or he's supposed to be born to a fisherwoman. But we celebrate Vyasa as one of the greatest sages. And Swami would say the Guru Purnima is celebrated in honor of sage Vyasa. And same is the case with Valmiki. Valmiki is not one of a very glorious past. He's literally like a saint with a past, because he's a dacoit who gets transformed. So Swami is the epics themselves hold out these characters as people, not only these characters of Rama and the Ramayana and Pandavas in the Mahabharata, as glorious for their moral standing, but even the authors of these epics are actually held as examples, because it doesn't matter where you are born, it doesn't matter how you are brought up, but if you have, as you said, conquered yourself, then you are looked up as a true conqueror, right, in that sense. And after that, of course, Swami, towards the end, I think today we'll be speaking about that, but Swami was referring to the Bhagavad Gita itself, how it stands out. I mean, this, we have heard this from Swami many times. What is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita? And it is Swami saying, Mama Dharma, the first word and the last word of the entire epic, Swami says, is the essence of the Gita. And I think we were talking about that also last week, right? Where Swami was speaking about the four goals, the Purusharthas, and how missing out any one of them is the cause for the disaster as we see in the society today.
Yes.
And then Swami spoke a little about the concept of Dharma itself, leading on to the Manu Dharma. Manu Dharma being one which speaks about, Swami used the term Niti and Nijayati in Sanskrit, where it talks about laws and legality in that sense, where Dharma is a very individual thing where you listen to the conscience. We were speaking about Atma Dharma and Paradharma.
Right.
But if you look at Manu Dharma, actually it's a very, very elaborate text on Dharma itself. Mm-hmm. Like what would a father do in a certain situation? What should a son do in a certain situation? When, you know, Swami would refer to the story of sage Durvasa when Krishna asks him to tell a lie. And Krishna says that you don't tell a lie, but you just modulate your voice to appear that, you know, you're, and you misguide the person who is trying to harm the other person. In fact, Swami would even make a reference to that sage who tries to save a deer by saying the ears which see cannot speak. I'm sorry, the ears which hear cannot speak, and the eyes that see cannot speak. I'm sorry.
So that's like getting off on a technicality.
Right. Well, of course, we know that very well. We see that quite often today. But that concept of Dharma is actually a little higher than even being accurate, technically speaking, as you're saying. So that Manu Dharma is supposed to be a text which talks about the ethics in all its complexities.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether, I mean, have you had the opportunity to go through Manu Dharma yourself?
Only in a very small, it's a very extensive document. And here's the thing, like, you know, different sections have to be read, you know, in consonance with several other texts.
Right.
Right. Because also there's some amount of, you know, confusion as to which one is the original form, because none of these are in the pristine form. Like there are portions which have got added, some got deleted and stuff. So there are many places where you'll find contradictions. Like, okay. So that is why the Manusmriti as such, you know, it's a remnant of something that has come down several ages, right? It's not like the Vedas. See, there's a beauty of it that the written texts, you know, sometimes they get lost or they get transformed. Right. But if you look at the Vedas themselves, they had a very elaborate structure around the Vedas, the ways of chanting, etc., which preserved the if a Veda is extant today,
right,
it is being chanted in precisely the same way as it was chanted originally, right? So, but unfortunately with many of these texts, they are not present. So what is present is based on a lot of commentaries.
Okay.
At least 3-4 commentaries have been written on the Manusmriti. So those are like very illuminating as such, because they throw light on like what are the duties. So broadly speaking, it's really like a legal document or a legal a guide.
Okay.
Right? So it goes through very, very intricate situations, like regarding marriage, you know, how do you dissolve a marriage, etc.
Okay.
So you'll actually find references to such things in the Manusmriti. So it's a very elaborate document. As with, you know, as intricate as Sanskrit grammar is, as complete Sanskrit grammar is, and you can imagine the amount of effort it would have taken years back.
Right.
So it is, and also a distillation. See, last time we spoke about Manusmriti is one of the several Dharma Sutras that are there.
Right.
There are in fact several that were written. Right, and this one is like they say a distillation of the various Dharma Sutras that were present. As we were speaking about last time, it actually the first reference to all this begins with the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad.
Mm-hmm, right.
So beginning there, so that's one of the first Upanishads. And beginning there, it has distilled down to the Manusmritis.
Mm, right. Well, I think we'll go to the next clip in that discourse. I think what we've done is a part of that clip is what we played last time, and just for the sake of continuity, because Swami, I think, started speaking about the German philosopher scholar Nish. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right.
Nietzsche.
Yeah. Okay. So Swami says that he chances upon this book and how he's so thrilled by. I mean, more than anything else, as you said, I don't think it's possible to completely go through a text like this and completely understand what it stands for.
Yeah.
But I think the when you go through a text like this, you're thrilled by the fact that the author of the book or the authors of such a book appreciated the fact that life is so complex, that there is no one rule that defines everything. And that is the main thing about Dharma, because if you read the Dharma Vaini, which is the most comprehensive thing that Swami has written on the concept of Dharma, Swami would always refer to that, you know, eventually it all goes back to that Atma Dharma. And we were speaking last time about it, where you literally make following the conscience literally like muscle memory.
Mm.
When you do it over a period of time in very small context and on various occasions, when the situation is complex, you automatically know what is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
In fact, there's that beautiful episode in the Mahabharata where the episode of the conversation between Yaksha and Dharmaraja, when he says, I'll give you back the life of one of your brothers, and he asks for one of the younger brothers who probably is not as useful if there was to be a war. And I mean, there is no deliberation in Yudhishthira's mind. He does not think about it. He does not debate within himself. He says, no, this is the right thing to do. Whether it is going to be beneficial to me or not is not of context at all. I need to ask myself, what is the right thing for me to do? I think that is what happens. A person who listens to the conscience all through life in different situations, however complex the situation is, probably he'll know what is the right thing to do. And maybe that is the reason why many times when we look at some of the decisions made by Yudhishthira or even the Ramayana, some of the decisions made by Rama, even today we are not able to accept it. But probably in that context, that character who was, Swami would say, you know, Ramo, Vigrahan, Dharma, he knew exactly what is the right thing to do. And in all our ignorance, we'll never be able to completely associate with that decision that he has made. And we still keep debating about it till today. Right. So shall we go to that next clip where Swami speaks?
Annintikini Mooladharam Enti Manu Dharma. ఈ మను ధర్మమునకు మించినటువంటి యొక్క ధర్మము ఎక్కడ కూడాను ప్రపంచంలో కూడాను కానరాదు.
మను ధర్మ, ద కోడ్ ఆఫ్ ధర్మ యాజ్ లేడ్ డౌన్ బై మను, ఈజ్ ద బేసిస్ ఫర్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్. వన్ కెనాట్ ఫైండ్ ఎనీ అదర్ ధర్మ ఇన్ దిస్ వరల్డ్ విచ్ కుడ్ సర్పాస్ మను ధర్మ.
ఒకనొక సమయం లోపల ఫ్రోడరిన్ నీచ్ అనేటువంటి జర్మనీ వేదాంతి.
Once upon a time, a German scholar named Nietzsche.
Itanu sankalpa shakti anetuvanta grandhani rastu undinadu.
He was writing a book on willpower.
Dini rastu unde samayam lopala atana adrushtavasattu ee manu charitra anaga manu dharmam atariki chikkindi.
When he was writing this book, fortunately he found the manu dharma.
Danini chustu తాను పొందినటువంటి ఆనందము వర్ణనాతీతమైనటువంటిది.
ద జాయ్ హీ డిరైవ్డ్ మియర్లీ బై గోయింగ్ త్రూ ఇట్ వాస్ ఇన్ఎక్స్ప్లికబుల్.
తదుపరి తాను రాస్తున్నటువంటి గ్రంథమును పక్కకు పెట్టాడు.
లేటర్ హీ కెప్ట్ అసైడ్ ద బుక్ హీ వాస్ రైటింగ్.
భారతదేశంలో గగన సీమ లోపల సూర్యుని వలె ప్రకాశిస్తున్నటువంటి ఈ మనుధర్మములకు ముందు నేను రాసేటువంటి ఈ గ్రంథము కేవలం క్యాండిల్ లైట్ వంటిది అనుకున్నాడు.
హీ థాట్ టు హిమ్సెల్ఫ్ that in the holy land of Bharat, in front of the Manu Dharma, which is shining forth like a sun in the sky, the book which I am writing is like a mere candle light. He said, one cannot see any other book beyond this one in this world. There is a kind of self-deprecation in them.
ఎంత విలువైన ఎంత పవిత్రమైనటువంటి యొక్క విషయములు తనకెంత ఉండినప్పటికీ పరుల యొక్క తత్వమును ఆకర్షించేటువంటిదిగా ఉండినప్పుడు తనీయుడైనటువంటి దురవస్థల పాలైపోతుంటాడు మానవుడు.
When a man finds the principles of others more attractive in spite of possessing something much more valuable and sacred, he ends up in a miserable condition.
దీనికి తెలుగులో ఒక విధమైనటువంటి పదం ఉంటుంటుంది.
There is a proverb in Telugu for this.
ఇంటి ఎందు చేసిన పంచభక్ష పరమాన్నముల కంటే ప్రక్కింటిలో పాచిపోయిన పప్పు చాలా రుచి అన్నారు.
ఇట్ ఇస్ సెడ్ దట్ మోర్ డెలీషియస్ దాన్ ది 5-course మీల్ ప్రిపేర్డ్ అట్ హోమ్ ఇస్ ద స్టేల్ లెంటల్స్ ఇన్ ద నైబర్స్ హౌస్.
మన ఎందు ఇంత పవిత్రమైనటువంటి యొక్క పదార్థములు ఉండి కూడాను ఏమాత్రమూ సాటి రానటువంటి సాటి లేనటువంటి యొక్క పరతత్వం యొక్క పదార్థమును ప్రేమించటము ఎంత వెర్రితనం.
ఇన్ స్పైట్ ఆఫ్ పొసెసింగ్ ప్రిన్సిపల్స్ ఆఫ్ సచ్ సీక్రెట్నెస్, to be attracted to principles outside which are in no way equivalent or even comparable to ours is such foolishness, isn't it?
Vidyarthulara,
students,
ee desham yokka vijnanam aaya deshamunaku pradhaname pramaaname.
Each country's knowledge is important and stands as a standard for that respective country.
Deenini evvaru kodanu vimarsincharadu.
None can criticize this.
ఆ దేశకాల పరిస్థితుల ప్రభావం పురస్కరించుకుని
as per that particular place, time and circumstances,
ఆయా దేశములకు ఆయా యొక్క విజ్ఞానములు ఆయా ధర్మములు కూడాను అవి చాలా ప్రమాణ స్వరూపాన్ని ధరిస్తాయి.
Each country adopts a certain type of knowledge and dharma as a standard.
కానీ అన్ని ప్రమాణములు కూడాను మానసిక పరిశుద్ధత కోసమే.
But all these standards are for mental purity alone.
భారతీయ విజ్ఞానము మానవాభ్యుదయములకు ఆదర్శవంతమైనటువంటి జీవితాన్ని అందించేటువంటిది.
భారతీయ నాలెడ్జ్ ఆఫర్స్ ఐడియల్స్ ఆఫ్ లైఫ్ ఫర్ హ్యూమన్ వెల్ఫేర్.
ఇట్టి మానవాభ్యుదయములు ఏమాత్రం కూడా మనస్సునందు చింతించక
వితౌట్ ఈవెన్ థింకింగ్ ఓవర్ ఇన్ మైండ్ అబౌట్ సచ్ హ్యూమన్ వెల్ఫేర్
ఆదర్శవంతమైన జీవితాన్ని మనం అందించక
వితౌట్ ప్రొవైడింగ్ ఎన్ ఐడియల్ లైఫ్
కేవలము గ్రంథములు మాత్రమే చదివి
మియర్లీ బై రీడింగ్ బుక్స్
విషయాన్ని తెలుసుకున్నంత మాత్రం చాలదు.
నోయింగ్ అ సబ్జెక్ట్ వుడ్ నాట్ బి అడిక్వేట్.
తెలుసుకున్న విషయాన్ని ఆచరణ ఎందు పెట్టాలి.
వీ నీడ్ టు పుట్ ఇన్ టు ప్రాక్టీస్ దాట్ వీ హావ్ కమ్ టు నో.
ఆచరణ ఎందు పెట్టినప్పుడే దీనికి ఆనందం మనకు ప్రాప్తిస్తుంది.
ఓన్లీ వెన్ ఇట్ ఇస్ పుట్ ఇన్ టు ప్రాక్టీస్ వీ కెన్ డిరైవ్ బ్లిస్.
అట్లు ఆచరణ లేకుండా సమయమునందు
when such practice is absent,
ఎన్ని గ్రంథములు చదివినప్పటికీ
how many of our books are read,
ఇవి కేవలము ప్రయోజనము లేనటువంటివిగా ఉంటాయి.
They would remain futile.
కోటి విద్యలు చదివి గుణము లేకున్నచో విలువ ఏమి దాని ఫలమదేమి.
After learning a million types of knowledge, if there are no virtues, what is its worth and how is it useful?
గుణము చాలా ప్రధానం.
So virtues are very important.
ఇలాంటి గుణములు పురస్కరించుకుని ఏ ప్రాచీన కాలం నుండి కూడా భారతీయులు ఈ గుణ ప్రచారమును సహజమైనటువంటి రీతిగా చాటుతూ వచ్చారు.
టేకింగ్ ఇన్ టు అకౌంట్ సచ్ వర్చ్యూస్ ఇన్ ఏన్షియంట్ టైమ్స్, భారతీయస్ ప్రొపగేటెడ్ ద వర్చ్యూస్ ఇన్ అ వెరీ న్యాచురల్ వే.
మన భారతీయ తత్వశాస్త్రములు కానీ వేదాంత శాస్త్రములు కానీ ఏ యొక్క విజ్ఞానం కూడా ఖండించడానికి అధికారమే లేదు.
No science has the authority to reject or refute the Indian philosophy and Vedanta.
ఈనాటి భౌతిక శాస్త్రము
today's secular sciences
రేపటి దినం పరిశీలన చేసి
will conduct research tomorrow
ఇది కాదని ఖండించి
condemn saying this is not it.
తిరిగి మరుసటి దినము నూతనమైనటువంటి యొక్క ప్రమాణమును పరిశోధన సల్పుతూ వస్తారు.
And the day after begin doing research on a new aspect.
మనకు ఈ క్షణ క్షణమునకును మారి కూరేటువంటి యొక్క ఈ విజ్ఞాన శాస్త్రము నిత్య సత్య స్వరూపాన్ని ధరించినటువంటి యొక్క భారతీయ యొక్క సంస్కృతిని కానీ లేక తత్వశాస్త్రమును కానీ న్యాయశాస్త్రమును కానీ ఖండించే అధికారం దానికి ఎక్కడ ఉంటుంది?
సో హౌ క్యాన్ ది సైన్సెస్ దట్ కీప్ చేంజింగ్ ఫ్రమ్ మోమెంట్ టు మోమెంట్ హ్యావ్ ది అథారిటీ టు రిఫ్యూట్ ఇండియన్ కల్చర్, ఇండియన్ ఫిలాసఫీ ఆర్ ఇండియన్ సైన్స్ ఆఫ్ జస్టిస్ that have adorned an eternal and true form?
Kant modalu Spencer varaku kudanu parishodhana chesinatvanti yokka vishayalannanta kudanu chakkaga vicharana chesthe.
From Kant to Spencer, if one were to thoroughly examine their research and findings,
Bharatiyulu parishodhana chesinatvanti yokka dvaita advaita visishtadvaitam yokka kumbhavarshamunaku వారు చేసిన పరిశోధనలు ఒక తుంపర్ల వలె కనిపించాయి.
ఇన్ కంపారిజన్ టు ద టొరెన్షియల్ డౌన్ పోర్ ఆఫ్ రీసెర్చ్ బై భారతీయర్స్ ఇన్ ఫిలాసఫీస్ సచ్ ఎస్ నాన్ డ్యువలిజం, క్వాలిఫైడ్ డ్యువలిజం అండ్ డ్యువలిజం, దేర్ రీసెర్చ్ అపియర్స్ లైక్ అ మియర్ డ్రిజిల్.
ఇవన్నీ కేవలము అల్ప స్వరూపం ధరించినటువంటివి.
దే ఆర్ ఆల్ మియర్లీ అ ట్రైఫ్లింగ్ ఫార్మ్.
That was the next clip in that discourse. As we said, Swami starts with the German philosopher's encounter with the Manu Dharma. I think he himself was planning to write a text on ethics and morality. I think that's what Swami was saying.
Yeah, he was a German philosopher who I think we made reference to earlier when we. So he also saw a being as being a. He's postulated a being who is greater than man, like just to call him as the Superman. So we find reference to that in his very famous book, Thus Spake Zarathustra. So it's like the ideal that we place in front of us, a person who has transcended the inner motivations, the inner urges and the bodily urges and the urges of what the mind dictates, right? And is able to do what is appropriate, right? And that was his ideal person, one, so to speak, who followed dharma. So that is when he encountered, the translation of the Manusmritis. In fact, he said that you can set aside our spiritual books and we can start reading the Manusmriti. He used to hold it in that high stead because he found the motivation for dharma over here more satisfying. See, in the Abrahamic religions, the motivation for doing something good or avoiding something bad is always, it's between punishment and reward. But here the motivation was something higher. So Manusmriti itself makes it very clear that the entire purpose is to actually realize Brahman. So this is one route. You follow your dharma, you do your duties, you follow the dharma that is laid down for you, and you'll automatically reach Brahman. That is the promise of the Manusmriti. So that source of dharma being the self, that was what attracted the philosopher Nietzsche to this way of thinking about dharma. So also, again, the many aspects, his way of thinking, it actually, there's a lineage of philosophers, German philosophers, and many of his thoughts are formed by their thinking. The Arthur Schopenhauer is one very famous German philosopher. So that's why you find a reference here on, it's called Will to Power actually. So that what are the various motivations for man? For a person to perform or a person to live, right? So there were several parallel philosophies. And one of them, Sigmund Freud, right? So he had his philosophy of, and based, the psychoanalysis based on his philosophies a lot. But this line of philosophers, they had a distinct way of looking at what drives mankind. And so they looked at the positive aspects, that what drives them is achievement, actually will to express oneself, right? So that way of thinking about man. So thinking about that only led him to this philosophy of a person who would, therefore, he would be able to set aside all barriers to his expression and be able to express himself fully as the ideal being, not motivated by some small rewards and petty things, but motivated by a very high purpose. So that's why he used to refer to such a person as the Superman. And again, if you see, George Bernard Shaw again uses the same concepts, and he he's written a book called Man and Superman. And again, there the concept is that this is a person who lives for a higher purpose and who is not bogged down by our everyday, you know, we can complain about so many things that are wrong with the world, like personal ailments or complaints about people around us, etc., right? And that can occupy, and our minds could be occupied with just dealing with that. But he looked at people who could transcend all of that, like let them be the way they were, but look at a higher purpose to live for.
Mm.
So that there's a lot of, you know, that thinking which has been handed down like generation to generation. All of this on just like what drives a person, what are the motivations for a human person.
Right. And what Swami is referring to here, you know, especially about the approach to all of these concepts, be it ethics or be it discipline, it's so different from country to country.
Yeah.
I think based on, as you were saying, the lineage of philosophers, you know, what they look at. In fact, I was reading a very interesting article on how the pattern of how people follow traffic rules changes from the west to east in a very interesting gradient.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, with a little bit of aberrations in between, you know, in countries like Paris, in some places, you know, in Italy and France, in some places where there's a deviation. But pretty much, they said that in the West, in the more developed countries, the concept is a rule which has to be followed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So even in the middle of the night, the road is completely empty, there's a red light, the person will stop and wait for the green light and go. Right? And they say that as you come towards the East, people say that, okay, there is a red light, but there is nobody going to be harmed if I go forward.
Mm-hmm.
So they follow the spirit of the law. But that becomes a little dangerous in some situations because that person factors in his abilities also.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a traffic light, you think that I'm good enough a driver to maneuver this corner. I can not follow this rule, but I won't hurt anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we find that problem with a lot of taxi drivers and auto drivers in the cities because they are so confident about their own way of driving. So it becomes very difficult for an amateur to fit into that traffic scenario. But that's a very interesting thing, how when they see rules in the Western, when they're brought up in that Western civilization, that need that a rule has to be followed. But as you come to the East and they say that nature, you can find it seeping into their philosophies and their way of looking at religion itself.
Yeah. So even if you look at the philosopher Nagarjuna, he developed a system of philosophy called Chatushkoti. Like, so in Western philosophy, you have a yes or a no answer. So here he could talk about other possibilities, like a yes and a no, right? Both coexisting simultaneously, right? And there is the Zen concept called mu, like, which doesn't answer anything. It's just, the answer is just pure silence. Right, so this is called the Chatushkoti method of thinking about, which is completely at loggerheads with, you know, in the rational West, you have a yes or no answer for most things. Right?
Mm.
But here, could be in complete silence. You know?
Right.
So both are included as possibilities, which drives many people up the wall, you know, when confronted with such logic, right? So that is, as you rightly said, no, that is a way of thinking that has developed here. Like that dilemma, like a dilemma is actually what? The path between two horns, right?
Mm.
So whether we can actually pass between those two horns, and so that is always something that we debate about, right? Like,
and I mean, it's so beautiful what Swami is saying here, because, you know, when you talk about philosophy, as you're saying, that there is a lineage of philosophers who over many, many generations mold this idea of philosophy. And if you talk of cultures being different, even to something simple as following a traffic rules, the idea of what is the purpose of life, what is dharma, what is morality, all of this is so complex and it has been passed down and molded based on these kind of thinkings. And when we pick up a rational education, westernized education, I think that is what Swami is saying, that you try to understand these philosophies with this mental makeup.
Correct.
And that is where the conflict starts. Right, and it's not that this cannot be understood through that, but probably a little bit of openness towards your in your approach itself.
Yeah.
same thing. I mean, it's not about just about the West trying to learn about the East. Mm. Even in the East trying to learn about the West,
yeah,
a little bit of broad-mindedness, I think, will give better understanding.
Correct, because they can coexist. You know, it depends on at that situation what is called for. And as you rightly said, an appreciation for why the systems developed the way they did, right? You don't need to condemn, throw aside one or decide on one for the other. Like there's, as somebody said, there's not necessarily a truth out there, right? So you pick like whatever, you know, appeals to you at that moment with the understanding that that may not be the truth.
Mm.
There could be a discovery. So the whole thing is a process of discovery. There's no end to that journey, right? So with that in mind, we should be able to navigate between these. So it's, as you said, completely all right. In fact, very important also to learn what are the different perspectives.
Right.
And appreciate like why this perspective has grown.
Right. Yeah. In fact, someone was referring to the difference in some of the way people approach life, even within Northern India and Southern India, where in Southern India, you find a little bit of laid-back nature in looking at life itself.
Mm.
Be it art, be it, you know, but you're not so aggressive compared to the North.
Mm.
And I'm not making a statement here. This is an observation that somebody is making. And they said it comes because of the conflict the Northern part of India has seen, which is much more than what the Southern part has seen.
Yeah.
The Southern part has seen stability over a longer period of time.
Yes.
And they've had stable kingdoms. The North has been subjected to different kinds of conquests.
Correct.
So they are a little more aggressive when it comes to making their stance, making their point.
Correct.
And so I mean, that much difference happens even within the country. So
right.
I think that open-mindedness to, I mean, and of course Swami says that right now we are in the state that anything which comes from outside it seems to be more sweeter and more palatable than what is our own. Swami says that, what is that Telugu thing which Swami says? He says the Panchabaksha Paramanam which is cooked at home is not as sweet as the dal which comes from outside. Right? In fact, Swami would tell one beautiful Chinnakatha where there were two shops in a market area. One was a medical shop and beside it was a coffee shop. So the medical shop owner, he had a headache. So he went to the coffee shop and he asked the man for a coffee. He said, I'm having a headache, give me a coffee. The coffee shop owner went to the medical shop and he said, can you give me a paracetamol? I'm having a headache. So he said, this is the nature of man today.
Yeah.
And then Swami was talking, of course, that part of every country has its expertise and systems and logics and it should not be criticized. In fact, I think even in the context of economics, this is something which is being spoken of, where you know we know that 1991, the liberalization of the Indian economy happened, where a lot of experts say that diffidence to open their economy actually came from the East India Company eventually leading to British rule.
Mm.
The feeling that a foreign company will come in the name of business and
correct.
Will take, you know, will inflict their rule upon us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're saying that that mental baggage was so long that it took a long time for India to open up.
Yeah. We had actually spoken about this right at the beginning. Again, Swami makes reference to how we not being able to appreciate our spiritual heritage and we are beginning to import, you know, Western heritage. Nothing wrong with Western heritage or Western culture
as it is.
And here comes the explanation, you know, so a reading of that would perhaps lead a person to think that there's something inferior about Western culture. But Swami is saying that, you know, that culture has developed organically in its own way. And here you have another culture which has developed organically in its own way. And both have their mutual benefits. So perhaps, you know, when you bring the two together, there's so much conflict that the advantages of both are lost. Right. So, in that sense. Plus, you know, one thing, like, even if you look at any system that evolves, right? Any system that evolves, it reaches a state of equilibrium, which is not like a stable equilibrium. It is something that, you know, there's something you throw in some other factor and it will start evolving again.
Right.
Back onto another
new equilibrium.
Onto another state of equilibrium, right? So, in that sense, like we got to appreciate that we cannot judge like one culture to another, right? It is a culture that has reached a certain equilibrium and will move on to something else from time to time. And as we see today, that movement is so fast, you know, generation to generation, people can see something changing in the in values. And if you notice, what happens is the youth, let's say the present generation, when they look at the actions of the senior generation, right? Like, so I am around 40 and I could look at people who are like 20, 25, and they have a different set of values. They're actually more broad-minded in several
more
ways.
More naturally broad-minded.
Yes.
They don't have to be taught to be broad-minded.
Exactly. So, because, you know, so sometimes the actions that we do, like they find them racist or bigoted. Just as, you know, some I would judge the generation maybe 20 years senior to me with in about the same way. So I realized that actually there is such shifting or morphing of values that the younger generation always, nowadays, will always find the senior generation lacking in values in their eyes, right? But, so I had to, like, once I was, you know, speaking to a 20-year-old and trying to discuss with them that this is what has happened. Like, it's not that I am particularly bigoted or particularly racist, but in my mind, like, this is what my brain has settled on as being an acceptable way of speaking and acting without my even knowing it.
So it's
important, therefore, to, as Swami said, no, to look at the background from where a certain way of thinking or a certain way of acting comes. And then you can choose to keep it or discard it.
Right.
There's nothing really so sacred. If you look at Adi Shankara, that is precisely what he did with a religion. Imagine, like, you know, that audacity that it would take to call upon certain things as being, which are in the religion, certain practices that are in the religion at that time, and to say that these are not part of the religion actually, and have them removed, right? Excised, and bring the core back into. That takes a lot of courage and audacity to do it, right? Yeah, and for that we need that, you know, openness of thinking as to, okay, the core principles, what do we come from, what do the human beings stand for, right? Look at whether it's consistent with that. If it is, keep it, otherwise you can discard it. Right?
In fact, Swami is making that very beautiful point, you know, but recognize that all systems of logic and philosophy are only for the purification of
exactly.
the mind.
Yes.
So if that is not happening, then there is no point in holding on to
yes.
it.
Yeah.
Or even criticizing. I mean, if I criticize another form of logic and moral system, I mean, if that is not going to help in my purification of the mind, then even that idea of criticizing another is meaningless.
Yes. As you always, you brought out, you know, in several times earlier, that when Swami refers to culture or it refers to spirituality, he's actually speaking about refinement.
Right.
Refinement of the mind. So that is the final goal, no? Like where we have to reach. And that is why, see, Swami holds Indian culture as, like, he says it because what it holds dear, right? That's what Swami makes clear, that if you look at the discourse, this section that we spoke about, Swami says right at the beginning that our sages gave no weight to money, fame, pleasures, power, physical or intellectual prowess, but only to dharma. That's why Swami says that this is a culture that is towering. Now the reason is, like, you can actually go back and analyze that the rest of the things, you know, they have very, very flimsy foundations. You talk about money, you talk about physical or intellectual prowess. These have very, very flimsy foundations, right? But if you look at going by dharma, dharma is something that is so innate. It is like literally if you translate it as duty, it is like the word you have given.
Right.
And nobody can take away your word. They can take your reputation away, money away, everything else away. But your word is something that sticks with you. So in that sense, right, this is a culture that stands apart. And which, if, you know, if you're actually able to lead by this, right, as against several other things, I get the feeling that maybe humankind would not find itself at the kind of stage that we are in today, right? Like, I mean, the last week has shown, like, you know, all the kind of thinking that we had till now, where it has led us to, right? Whether the old values that the Sanatana Dharma held dear, maybe it's a very good time to again revive them, right?
I think that's a very good point that you did, that you made, that Swami is calling us to look at this as valuable because of the adherence to dharma and giving that priority to dharma, rather than sticking purely to the external factors, the exactly. rituals and the practices. In fact, even if you look at probably a character like Dharmaraja, Yudhishthira in the Mahabharata, probably Swami would say this, the only flaw that he had was his weakness to indulge in the act of gambling. And, you know, maybe that there's a reason for making that character like that. Nowhere else you would find Yudhishthira blaming anybody else for what he is undergoing. And, you know, here is somebody who has a weakness, and because of his weakness, there is a sequence of events which is set forth. So he's completely accepting that I did something wrong and I'm getting all of this as a consequence of that. And that nature, that I have a flaw and I accept it, maybe that is also something which we are missing. We are looking at Dharmaraja and we might say that, oh, that's a weakness and I don't have that weakness. Probably, you know, you look at it that way. And that's what we do whenever Swami speaks about Arjuna doubting Krishna. And we would say that, oh, I don't have that kind of a doubt. You know, I believe in Swami completely. But the characters are very, very profound and multifaceted in that level. And as you are saying, if you look at it as they are being given importance for their dharma in various situations, not only when they are right, their dharma even when they are wrong, what follows after they've done a mistake is something which needs to be emulated and looked deeply into.
Exactly.
And Swami is again emphasizing on the importance of practice, which I think Swami did so many times in this discourse earlier and in, I think, a couple of discourses back, where Swami spoke extensively for a long period on the importance of practice, where pure knowledge is not good enough. In fact, even in the beginning of this discourse, we were talking about ethics and how there are experts in ethics who know exactly what needs to be done, and that actually becomes a hurdle for them to not do what is the right thing. They know how to get out of a situation, and that becomes a dangerous twist.
Yeah. Right. In fact, you can look at this in various spheres, right? If you had to say the truth about it, most of us know what is the right thing to be done at a particular point of time. If you look at a student, for example, you ask the students, what do they need? See, they might come and ask you, give me guides or tips on how to succeed. But in fact, you put them on a stage, they'll be able to tell you precisely what has to be done. But they are the people asking these questions, right? So what is it, you know, that has them know what's the right thing to do, but not actually do it? Mm-hmm. You know, that is an interesting question. Like, for example, they say in Mahabharata, again, coming to the character of Duryodhana, again, he is like very well aware of what the dharma is. But there is something that is coming in his way of actually practicing it. You look at Ravana. Like Ravana, as we said, very learned, right? So knew, like in comparison to Lord Rama, Ravana was extensively studied. Right. That those 10 heads represent his scholarship in 10 fields of knowledge, right? So he knew that much, and yet when it came to actual practice, right, that is where he slipped, right? It can happen in the fields of spirituality. It can happen in the field of our everyday, like worldly pursuits. Like very simple thing, like how does one lose weight? And everyone knows what has to be done. But how many of us are actually able to stick to a, you know, plan? So what comes in the way of that? That is the interesting question, right? What comes in the way of actually implementing, actually acting? So there's no real value in knowing something. The value is in actually putting that into practice.
Right. In fact, we do it the other way around. You know, we look at a successful person, we look at a person who probably has lost weight, and we ask them how you do it.
Correct.
And there's always enough gyan, as you're saying. That gyan, even the person who is not lost weight can give you.
True.
But, I mean, that shows how much importance we give to achievement itself. You know, what the effort which goes into it. Somebody who has like started a small business, 4 or 5 friends come together and start a business and becomes an international corporation now. There is, I mean, he can list out 10 reasons why he was successful, but it's not that alone. As Swami would say, there are 100 factors which are beyond your control, which has helped you in that success. But we value those 10 points which that person gives because there is effort behind those words. Yeah. They're not just philosophy. And that's why Swami is saying that even an ounce of practice is much more important and valuable than, you know, immense learning.
Mm.
And I think that was the last point that Swami made. That, and of course, after that, Swami speaks about literally how you should not take science too seriously. And that's what science itself wants. That it's a process, and the process is an ongoing process. It's like what it says today, the glory of science is in looking back and contradicting itself, saying that we have learned something more, we want to update our comprehension on this particular theme.
Yeah. You'll always find the scientists who are at the cutting edge of science.
They are always like that.
Yes, so you'll never see them have that hubris called, we know everything, right?
Mm.
That so they can, in a sense, look at the philosophy of science itself and look and say that science studies phenomena that can be studied.
Right.
And the scientific method admits certain kind of phenomena, like which are repeat, you know, which can be repeated or replicated, etc.
Right.
There is a large set of phenomena that fall outside the ambit of science, right? And like as God plays hide and seek, right? Likewise, some of these things are really beyond the explanation. And therefore it takes, like as a person, you know, there was one person who was asked, like he was not known to be a believer of God or an atheist for that sense.
Mm.
So when he was asked, like, what is, do you believe in God? So he gave a very, very nice reply. He said, I got space for God to show up in my life.
Beautiful.
Right, I set aside a space where God can show up in my life. There's no writing God off or, you know, completely blindly accepting. Because there is that humility called, I cannot ever know God.
Right.
And even those of us who've been here, you know, I asked Brother Satyajit once, who had the fortune of attending to Bhagwan physically for 13 years. Right, and I thought that who else can tell me whether he knew what Swami wanted, he knew how Swami could think. He said no. Like, it's maybe easier for us to understand a human, but Swami, there's absolutely no chance of predicting how he would say, what he would do. You know, so he said that's something really difficult. And he's a very grounded person. He's not like a, what shall I say, like a hagiographic account called, you know. He's saying as lived. My experience as lived was no. It was very difficult. I've asked this question of Mr. Chakravarti, whether he could anticipate or think like what Swami would say in a particular situation. He said, try as much. You know, when you think you've learned everything, then there's something else which Swami will show and say, no, I'm actually here. so really in that sense, like God is somebody you cannot bound, you know, even rationally speaking.
Right. Yeah. As you're saying that, the important thing is to leave that space, and both ways. at the risk of saying that, not saying that leave that space for atheism, leave that space for the absence of God, but leave that space for the belief that you have not understood God completely.
Correct.
I mean, that's how your understanding of God will grow. But if you say that this is God and this is what the Shastras say, that he has four hands and he has a crown on his head, and I mean, that's again an act of fixing God. You know, just like how saying that there is no God is an act of fixing and closing the bringing closure to the topic. Saying that this is what God is also a closure to the topic, which I think is dangerous.
And that is actually in essence a scientific method.
Right.
Right. Because when you because you have to keep your mind open for something, for data to come in or for evidence to come in, and never close an issue. Like, I think, like, if you see, all research is basically founded on that.
Right.
That there is something more, or this may not be right. And that's how we have moved from classical mechanics to general relativity or onto quantum physics. You know, so somebody like Einstein, who had such a vivid imagination and could perform thought experiments which could see, you know, what an ordinary person couldn't see, like something like special relativity, general relativity, you know, mathematically those are easy to accept, but for a physicist to see that in his mind is an incredible feat, right? And he could do that, but that was his limitation. When it came to quantum physics, he said his main limitation was that he couldn't do thought experiments which would predict quantum physics. Quantum physics is such a mathematical subject, right? That even if something non-intuitive comes out, you have to accept it.
Mm.
Like, for example, the very famous example they give is the equations predicted a particle called the positron, which was the negative of an electron. Like an electron's mass with a positive charge. Mm. Now, people thought, what a weird particle. Can it exist in nature? And it took many years. What was mathematically shown as present, it took many years for it to show up as an actual detectable particle. Right? So, there, mathematics trumps your intuition. And so, he had a certain way of thinking, which actually was far superior to many human abilities at thinking. But that became his, obstacle. It's an unbelievable thing. But that became his obstacle because he said that God does not play dice with the universe, alluding to how quantum mechanics is all about probabilities. There's no certainties there.
Right.
And he said God doesn't play dice with the universe.
Mm.
That got replaced with scientists physicists who came after him to say that God not only plays dice but also throws them at a place where you cannot see the dice.
Absolutely.
That's
the beautiful point, you know, as you're saying, the scientists who are in the peak of their trade, if you could put it that way, they are humble because to give up an understanding which they had yesterday is a day-to-day thing for them.
Correct.
That every day they learn something which contradicts something they believed in yesterday.
True.
So that a true scientist who is really there, who is really doing that science, understands that. And I think same is the case with somebody who is a true devotee. You know, a person who quotes science to say atheism is actually way away and he's the fanatic there. Same is the case with a devotee. A true devotee, like for instance Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, you know, Vivekananda would say that he is more Advaitin than me.
Correct.
You know, he talks of the Advaitic concepts and Vedantic concepts with much more groundedness and with a feeling of, you know, nearness much more than somebody who has read a book, even though he is not a person of that path, literally. You know, he is a devotee. It's because he is in the pinnacle of that path of devotion. So I think, but a person who claims to be a devotee, reading a few textbooks and develops an idea of God, I think they are the ones who become the fanatics.
Yeah.
That this is my God and this is how God must be. Both ways, you know, whichever religion you belong to, anything taken to with sincerity is going to lead you to the same knowledge. I think that's the beauty of the Vedanta itself. And Swami would say in the Jnanavaini, you know, you take the path of Jnana, you take the path of Bhakti, it's going to all come to the same point, as in Bhagavad Gita Swami says, that the best devotee is actually a jnani. You know, artha, arthati, jignasu and jnani. He's actually four types of devotees, but Swami says the best devotee becomes a jnani. And the best jnani will always become a devotee. You know, that's the beauty of the thing. So if we are very strongly feeling about any one particular concept of God, absence or presence, I think maybe we need to give ourselves a little more time and be a little more sincere in our quest itself.
Yeah, because if you look at Swami also, he would also do this all the time. I have heard him say, at several times, you know, for example, he would say, God exists only in your imagination. Right? And he would say things like, you know, like the portraits that we see of God. He would
tell Ravi Verma's imagination.
He would say, right? Ravi Verma's imagination, God looks nothing like that. You know? Like, so, there are several times, you know, so if you go to Swami with a concept, he will shatter it in no time.
Right.
There's nothing you can hold dear. Like, I remember at a time, I had this impression that, you know, Swami was against marriage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I go to him with this, strong brahmachari concept. I go to him and he says, no, marriage is like, you know, everything in this world has its place and so does marriage. You know, it's like not even a blade of grass. I was like looking aghast at Swami. Then I realized that I have not discovered for myself.
Right.
What is it that Swami has to say about a certain aspect? It takes a lot of study.
Right.
Enormous amount of study. And discourses are only just a part of, you know, that huge body of, like, you got to learn about interactions that Swami has had with devotees, or what he has said about a particular topic in person to certain people. Like, you can, it's a huge, this one, ocean out there.
It's like archaeology, you know, finding the place where you can find the artifact is only the beginning. You have to then dig. Right, the digging process is a completely different thing. Excavation is a completely different activity.
Yeah.
But at least we have found the place, right?
Exactly.
And this is the place where we need to dig and dig deeper. So probably we'll conclude with that. We'll continue with this discourse next week. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guests for the day for the Vahini Satsang. But we'll join you again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam.